Lisa, when it got vandalized and twice, I think they put it back and now it's no longer there, but it was a really good sign. Didn't really have any how to take care of it or what to do, but in terms of interpretation, that's probably for the next one. But at two of the entrances, there are park rules posted, and you know, and people, domoic acid or special things, that's on that same signboard. So there's only two entrances, two main entrances from Fogarty Creek State Park, but there is an informal entrance that comes off Highway 101 near Surf Rider Hotel, because that's where they went in to put riprap and became unofficial, but since the unofficial entryway, but since the stairway from Fogarty, from Surf Rider no longer exists, that's where all the people from the hotel, which is up above those two, so that that would be an area for additional signage. So that's where people really probably would get their information. But there's two restrooms, and that would be also a good place, because there's only two restrooms. Okay. Is that what you meant?
Yeah.
Good, yeah, they don't keep it over there for a second.
Yeah, I was thinking in terms of Cape Foulweather on Autocrest Loop Drive. There's several pullouts there. And Seven Capes Bird Alliance worked with national agencies, Lex Bay National Wildlife Refuge, to put in educational signage with artwork about 7 or 8 along a half mile loop there. They went in place about 2 years ago, and when I walk that trail, I see people stopping there and looking at the signs and reading them because they're so very attractive. And I think some of the pull-off sites along Autocrest Loop could meet that purpose really well, where you're providing the public with information about what they're seeing, what the designations are, that offshore islands, the marine reserve, the rocky habitat site, and some of the cultural uses of at Cape Foulweather. So I think that might be one way to go.
Absolutely. A couple things. One, we've yet to explore the concept with the county as to signage, but I think Autocrest, there's a lot of storytelling opportunities. At a very basic level, if someone wants to know where are all the marine designations in Oregon, what are they about? You go to the ODFWE regs and you look at it and go, well, I live at Cape Foulweather. I know it's an MCA, but it's not on the map. It's not on the map because there's no regulated, there's no reg changes that are site specific. So I'm hoping this process, and I want to mention the workshop of getting Cape Foulweather and Black Hawk Point on the EREG map, I think is important.
And so you mean like in the magazine?
Yeah.
That is a good point. And I think my assumption for why that is that there's no specific change in ODFW rules.
Yeah.
There will be a change in Department of State land rules at that site. But it is confusing for someone who's trying to find information about the network of conservation areas, you know, and then they're looking at that magazine or that, there's also a PDF or, you know, website for the e-regulations. If it's not there, it's a little confusing, for sure.
We were just saying here.
Yeah.
So ODFW does have digital versions of all the rules for all these areas, but it's difficult to find it at this point.
Uh-huh.
And so it's not in our support regulations, but it is in our overall knowledge base, as the team was talking about.
Yeah, so you're correct that the only things that are in our e-regulations booklet and shown in those maps in it are things that have changes to the regulations, ODFW regulations. There is very hidden in odfw.com/marine map, the marine map, which is actually an ArcGIS map where you can click on the different sites, that has all of them regardless of whether or not there's a change to regulations. So that could be something that we could use for information sharing, linked to in a way that's easier to find. Because unless you're really looking for it, it definitely gets hidden within the booklet.
Yeah. Absolutely, and I actually use that website almost, or the map, almost daily.
Me too.
And what's nice about that, the GIS map, is that it shows the overlapping areas. So, for example, at Otter Rock, you know, it shows very clearly where the Marine Garden overlaps with the Marine Reserve. Yeah. And so that would be the case at Fogarty as well, show the small area where the two sites overlap. I definitely think that that's a good avenue for that.
I'm not sure why we haven't unveiled that. You know, we put that together. That came out of the Shellfish Program.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what the plans are in terms of that. It could be that we're waiting for this two-part workshop to finish off and then add that information in. So I'm not sure.
I know the goal, though, is to make that eventually more available and accessible.
Excellent. Yeah. I didn't know about that resource. One strategy might be to get that blasted out to other places, like even chambers and that sort of thing, where people are fishing around about where to go, they could, you know about that. Another alert area to know about it, in my mind, is drones. We have regular incidents where people, A, don't see the sign that says no drones, B, get too close to wildlife, C, actually disturb them. And they say, well, I went to Before You Fly, which is an FAA site, and we're not on there. So I mean, there needs to be some. And I know the drone is a separate issue, but I mean, there needs to be a kind of spread of information about each of these places and what the restrictions are. And I would hesitate to say it should go to the chamber because they just advertise, come on down. So we don't want that, but
right. You
know, it's a matter of getting some precaution information in any of those sites that people look at.
Yeah.
I just put a couple notes just listening to folks here. One thing I heard are, you know, opportunistic signs. When you're on site, you want to learn about that area, and that's really that person who's either just stumbled onto it or is planning in advance. And then the second is this category of signage and information so you can let people know how to plan to go there. You
before
that destination.
Before they go, yeah.
A pretty dramatic difference.
Yes.
Information. Well, while I'm chatting, I wanted to say something. I don't know if this is still the case. Last time I was involved in signs, it was that 333 kind of rule that, you know, spend 3 seconds on it, 30 seconds on it, and others who want 3 minutes to spend the whole time. And is that still, we could think about signs on site?
I'm not familiar with that rule. Are you familiar with the 333?
So, like, it's essentially some people will just look at the title.
Okay.
Some people will read, like, the first and last sentence of a paragraph. And then some people will stop and read the entire sign word for word. And if you watch groups at different places, you'll notice, like, they kind of move in and out with, like, that person did it, that person didn't. But yeah, it's like
so is that signs should contain all three of those, the 3, the 30, and the 3, or the design the sign was to be?
It kind of depends on what you're asking. Yeah. And what you're trying to communicate, which is kind of my fundamental question, is what information are we trying to share and why?
Yeah, no, thank you. I mean, I think that'll come up. Julia, yeah.
Yeah, I was just thinking about other ways of information sharing, clear signage, obviously being a big one of them too. I know the Cape Perpetua Collaborative has worked with the AACA, or the Seniors Association, to try to partner with some of the local hotels and VRBOs to create like a pamphlet that could be left in a hotel room or those things that has regulations, title etiquette, safety,
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. That's definitely something that AQUA has, the Oregon Coast Visitor Association has identified rocky habitat etiquette as like something that's important, particularly this year, in their program. Yeah, Frank.
I forgot to mention that there was a sign designed by the Step Rock Interpretive Program. Beautiful work in collaboration with Ron Popish, a very wonderful artist. And he offered to adapt it for a fee, but low fees, and then we could get them produced. And because the people are on the East Coast that make the sign, shipping costs are high. But I think what's held up for the movement is that state parks isn't sure whether they're want to allow additional signs. So that really needs to be, because they're beautiful signs, and there's no reason to reinvent the wheel. And because of the beautiful artwork, people might look at the pictures and that can, you know, give some ideas of what organisms to look for, both animals and plants, and intertidal. It's a wonderful resource and I would hate not to use it.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that, Fran. And actually last week there was just a ribbon cutting and unveiling of those signs you're mentioning down at Coquille Point in Bandon. So there are two different signs that were designed by Ron Popish, or illustrated by Ron Popish. And so I think the main question I have for you all, particularly about interpretive signs, we're kind of transitioning into our interpretation conversation, is what are there differences in ways that we want, that we would like to interpret these two sites? So, yeah, Ken.
One thing to keep in mind is these two sites, in a lot of ways, are very, very different from each other. And one of the ways is Foggy Creek is very high use Otter Cape Bellwether. Generally, we'll use this up some really busy points like Otter Crest Viewpoint. But I think for both of them, we're not looking with information of how to increase visitation. But the quality of the experiences that we're focused on. And that'll shape how you market it, how what information goes into it.
Yeah.
Another thing that I just thought of while I was here is that often we signage sort of assumes that the natural environment is static throughout the year. But it would be really nice to inform our visitors, if you're here in the wintertime, this is what you may see. If you're here in the fall, this is what's happening. If you're here in the spring, something else is going on. But to have that that information available easily. Yeah,
so that reminds me of what someone said in their intro, that like the view always changes. It's constantly, every time you look at it. Yeah, Dennis.
Yeah, this reminds me of a couple of things. This people thought this is a great invention here. With regard to the seasonal signs, I mean, the state has these wonderful bird nesting signs that, you know, there's a precautionary Thanksgiving on climb the fence, stuff like that. So that's one thing. Another thing is we actually did use Ron Popish for a map of the area. So what it does, and thank you very much for letting us post it on the fence. But what it does is it sort of gives people a way to get down to this place they want to go without climbing, but also precautionary areas where you don't, where you cannot go. There are birds nesting here, there's wildlife here. So sort of a guidance sign is another thing. The third thing is in the chambers, I don't want to see, have them draw people there, but they could include in the literature typical etiquette and stuff like that. Not naming any places, but just saying if you go, don't do this or do this or.
In the, sorry, would you say that again? In the what pamphlet?
In the informational, the Discover Depot Bay.
Okay, yeah.
Literature has nothing in the way of precautions in this way. And that's, I think, an opportunity to try to insert things that are etiquette based.
Right. Did you have a comment?
Yeah, I have a question about, oops, in regards to a piece of information that's come up a couple of times, and that's around drawing people to these locations. actively trying to displace use from them or shut them off?
No.
So there's state parks too, right?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
I'm just saying that for delicate areas, we don't want to invite people for events. But I mean, obviously, state parks go for it.
Yeah.
You know, but there's some areas that are just more delicate. And somehow we've got to get messages.
Yeah. It's very baked in. It's a fundamental to the Rocky Habitat Management strategy to protect the sites, but also provide for current and future use.
Correct.
So how do you? That's
the kind balance.
Of, how do you protect? How do you balance? But how do you maintain that access?
Just another idea out there. We mentioned aqua earlier, and maybe providing literature for some of the whale watching companies to pass out when they're out on the ocean looking at the Rocky Habitats.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's definitely a lot of whale watching interpretation that happens, especially in this part of the coast. So I just have another question. To get to the right area here. So we're talking about interpretation, you know, education programs, stewardship goals for the sites. So what are educational needs for the site, or are there challenges in terms of supporting or establishing education programs at the site? Fran.
At least Fogarty, there is quite a diversity of used by different ethnicities, Spanish speakers, there's actually Pacific Islanders, Russian Orthodox folks, but at least Spanish, having some of the critical signage in, or having a QR code or something that provides access to the information for Spanish speakers at least.
Absolutely. The Shellfish program is really good about that as far as posting different regulations around openings and closures and different languages, which I really appreciate. I think one thing that's really important to me as far as education, and this gets back to information sharing, is if there is going to be any research or monitoring in these areas, that's communicated back to our communities. Fogarty in particular, we know it abuts a designated research area, and that's a pretty prominent research area. How many times have they been to City Council to share any of their work or had any workshops or symposiums about what they're finding in those areas? So if this is something that's going to happen, I would really like to see a better interplay between the monitoring and the community and different educators within that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for bringing that up. And that's something that we've heard at the other sites as well, is that it's, you know, when we're planning for this type of interpretation, even signage, how do people find out what sort of ongoing research is happening? Kent, I was wondering, or Steve, if you would mind mentioning the idea that came out of the proposal for the State of the Cape Symposium.
I was just going to mention that we proposed in our proposal that every 2 years we have a biennial State of Cape Symposium, like for Cape Thalwater or for Cape Lookout, which is our other proposal, where we could share what's going on, what have we learned, what do we need to do, what's working, what's not working, that kind of purpose.
And I think we
can
wrap Fogarty into that.
Yeah.
I think it's important, too, for when you're considering new signage locations to consider the auxiliary things that come with signage, such as like increased trampling, increased trash on the ground. Who's going to be maintaining these sites where the signage is going to be? Are they going to be responsible for maintaining vegetation at the site? Are they going to be picking up trash that we know is going to be left at that site from visitors, whether intentionally or not? So I think it's important to know who's going to have the responsibility for maintaining the signage and then also maintaining the area around the signage. Because a lot of these places, especially on Ottercrest Loop, it's a straight shot down into the rocky habitat. If someone rips off a corner of a granola bar and it's going to go flying over the edge, we don't want to inadvertently start adding materials to that area that aren't inaccessible for us to maintain and clean up. So just considering like a plan around that.
I mean, you're right. I was walking the loop about 3 weeks ago, and a whole bunch of garbage right over the edge from, theoretically, an RV that was parked on the east side of the pull-out there.
Yeah, gathering places will inevitably accumulate more trash. So just being mindful of where we're putting those places. If we know that there's, like, Pitch and Guillemot nesting sites or, like, Black Oyster Catcher nest sites in certain areas, like, we still want to have signage, we still want to have community interpretation maybe in those areas, but being a little bit more strategic about where those might be, knowing that trash will be a problem, or trampling, or like cars parked where we don't want them to be parked, or traffic implications, something like that.
Well, I think in terms of that, maybe in terms of what use we allow there, walkers, pedestrians, bicyclists, people who are driving their cars, maybe RV vehicles that are camping overnight? No.
Dennis, did you have a comment?
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, these two things are linked, because there is such a thing as interpretive signs. And okay, fall weather has like 7 of them, all of which are weathered and you can't read them. So, you know, those replacement and, or maybe even consideration of what's the appropriate mix of things up there? There's nothing about the tribes up there. So I argue that if you don't have the community support for things like volunteers who are going to be physically doing interpretation, there should be a collection of some sort, I think, for those signage topics.
Well, I guess that kind of brings me to the jurisdiction question, because certain portion in, you know, Cape Foulweather, Autocrest Drive is county property, and then a certain portion is parkland. So I'm curious if you all have any insights about that. Or
you have mixed jurisdictions in those areas. You're going to be dealing with county jurisdiction in some cases and right of ways. In some cases, it would be ODOT. In other cases, state park. Oh, I'm sorry. Some cases it'll be ODOT's right of way. Some cases it'll be state parks, and there's
or
generally
private ownership
or
too.
Private ownership. There is some private ownership in these areas, especially in the Fogarty Creek area. So you've got a lot of coordination between agencies, especially when it comes to law enforcement. So you'll find the county sheriff's department and state police will probably work together to some degree on bigger issues. But as far as basic management, solid waste collection, things like that, there's probably a lot of unanswered questions to how that gets addressed.
Right.
As far as signage goes, I wouldn't worry too much about it. Informational signage is pretty easy. But I would point out, there's this thing called the broken window effect. So if you have signage that's deteriorating and falling apart over time, it kind of compounds itself. People see a broken down sign, they start leaving their garbage out. So maintaining these signs and this infrastructure is a good way to keep people from dumping garbage and creating a mess. So.
Yeah, thank you.
QR codes can be also a thing that people can do to get a whole lot of information, and they can choose how they need to go.
Okay.
But just a simple QR code, maybe several of them, whatever your touring.
Right.
In various areas, I think is another option.
There has to be
one service. Not for Cape Foulweather, though. Is that loose?
She knows that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome.
That's right.
But they can take a picture later on.
Yeah.
Ask her
if you can carry out to you.
Then you find out. Have you got any?
I mean, that is kind of jumping back to my initial question about, like, what are we trying to communicate and why. I think that really dictates, like, what we're actually doing. So is it just a regurgitation of regulations, or are we trying to articulate something else?
Yeah, thank you for the question. So it is important to know that OPRD is in the process of drafting new regulatory signs for the site. So on the poster over there, I have an example of what a marine conservation regulatory sign would look like. This one is specific to Cape Lookout, but we are OPRD is developing two regulatory signs for each of these sites. We don't know exactly where they'll go yet, and I'm sure that'll kind of be, you know, up to your management unit. So there are some options down on the bottom there. There's different images that we can kind of pick and choose from. And so if you have any comments on this draft of the regulatory sign, please feel free to like write on the sign, and we'll share that information back. There's also a PDF in the Google folder that you can leave comments on as well. But I think today, you know, talking more about the interpretive sign, I don't think we'll have to, you know, try and relay as much of this kind of information. And there are actually two symbols that that are related to tidepool etiquette. So on the regulatory sign. And so I think the opportunity we have is sort of to think about what kind of story do we want to tell? You know, do we want to have a sign that is about tribal use of the site? Do we want to have interpretation around the different organisms or seasonal changes? And do we want them to kind of, we want the signs to kind of reflect the type of in-person volunteer interpretation that happens, if that makes sense.
Quick clarifying question. I didn't see a very similar signs. Can you still find a rock at Fogarty?
Sorry, say it again?
Can you still find a rock at Fogarty?
That is, so I don't think that there are any regulations that prohibit climbing on rocks. I think that is strongly in the etiquette field, which also ties into the interpretation. So when we have volunteers on the ground at Fogarty, I've seen volunteers approach people and say, hey, did you know that there's like 100 living beings on this rock, you know? So it's not a legal or rule of regulation. It's more of how do we communicate etiquette that that's not tied to a rule.
So Fogarty, that rock has always been climbed.
Yeah.
It's pretty bare because of that.
Yeah.
There's no birds anymore, nothing. There are some mussels, but that's a different area of the rock. But other places where there's offshore, where there's offshore rocks, you know, this is sort of offshore, but that's where those don't climb are more important. I don't think we'd ever be able to enforce, so I think you have to be practical, unfortunately.
Yeah. Anyone that's in rescue than that?
It's also just like, again, like the dynamic nature of that beach just eroded, right, way in the natural process.
Well, let's move on to monitoring and community science. Because this part of the conversation is really cool. I'm really excited. Also, Claire ran out of space on the slide. So it's okay. So just to transition to monitoring and community science. First of all, what kind of monitoring has occurred at these sites in the past? How can site monitoring continue or expand going forward? And then, you know, because we have shellfish folks in the room, you know, I'm curious how community science efforts can support sort of ongoing research that ODFMW already participates in, and if you have kind of done any kind of data sharing before with community groups.
Yeah, I'll be happy to address that. So for big foul weather area, the Marine Reserves Program has monitoring on the rock. Melissa Miner talked about the Marine Multi-Agency, that's a long-term monitoring site. And scientists here at Oregon State University have also been looking at this site, this area, for a long time. So it's good databases to make those comparisons. Shellfish program, we don't do that. We're a small subgroup. Now, at times we do have information about human extraction out of the sites, the first one, the other, who's neck barnacles, muscles. And then I've been doing the NOAA on the Federal National Muscle Project.
Coast does, and that's a very highly developed one. green debris, do you go with NOAA or who? that one. Sea star monitoring. Water quality. I mean, this is the Blue Water Task Force type of thing where you can get kids involved. That's a very good one. And you guys have been doing mussels. And that's with these little quadrants out there. I didn't even know that until you arrived at Otter Rock with these quadrants and started to do it. That would be another interesting thing. But I think that one's about, you know, what happened to the predators as well as have they grown because predators are gone? A very interesting question. And I'd love to know the answer to that. Anyway, so there's a group of, you know, what are the possibilities? Not appropriate for every area, but then how does the reporting get to be robust and useful?
I think Steve had a comment.
Yeah, I just, on your point, I think it's very valuable, but I think we need to think also about how do we coordinate developing consistent monitoring and comparing information. And I think that is a potentially wonderful project that could be grant funded in a major kind of way. Yeah.
I was
going to
make a point real quick that we're talking about lots of different things here. Long-term monitoring typically is that practice of going out and repeatedly measuring a few things for a long period of time, often spatially replicated. And that's where these protocols are super important, to make sure that you can compare apples to apples over year to year, place to place. The site-based research are very often question-based in the short term. Answer it 2 years, 3 years, even less. Sometimes an experiment, sometimes manipulation, like a scrape free or caging, you know, those kinds of things, or addition of predators or taking away predators, those types of things. So that type of site-based research poses a whole different kind of questions about whether that should be encouraged or not at particular sites.
I just had a question. At some of the other sites where there's been short-term research projects, what's the permitting process like? Is there one for community science?
So in order to get permission from the state and the feds to do that, there's a joint OEFW, NOAA, scientific tape permit, and there are conditions in there for manipulation of populations, for extraction of animals. So we have that research exemption, no matter where. There's a really big compelling reason to do a site-based research project at a site, and you can apply for that. And that informs the feds, informs our team about what's going on. Typically, we can add to that, put conditions on it, help add our contacts and information, logistics. And
is there anything like that set up for some of those long-term monitoring community science projects where maybe there is a concern about trampling or overuse? Maybe it's not a physical tape, but there's still some sort of impact.
When you say no,
yeah.
It's inappropriate to say no.
Big one. So weird to call it Cape Falwether because it's off of Rocky Creek as well. One big question that I have there and been pressing help experts to investigate is like, why is there help there and why is it so massive right now compared to other places along the coast?
That's just spectacular.
Yeah. Great to see. Love to see it. Why? Like, what are the conditions and how can we potentially replicate that elsewhere? Like, where can we, can we apply lessons from there?
Yeah, can.
Yeah. The Oregon Kelp Alliance just came out with their status report, which has coastwide as a monitoring and follow with it. I think there is a community science opportunity of mapping kelp, at least plot points from visually, from the surface. I mean, Orca's got volunteer divers, land-based opportunities there too.
I mean, there's so much local knowledge at Morocco there of that place that I think is like critical to tap into that like scientists don't usually think of. I've got into this and that, we're in an AFS conference this year about these kelp beds and people talk about like, well, how do you know that? It's like, because I look at photos of me as a kid there. Like, so I think that that's something that needs to be considered. consider too when talking about community science and community understandings and community knowledge is maybe, especially if we're trying to be in some sort of intergovernmental agreement with the tribes, like maybe a better way to break that. But yeah, help. Kick the hauler, Rocky Creek. Let's figure it out.
They're not barracks there.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. Why is that?
Can I add a point there? So I've obtained funds from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to do statewide kelp surveys. We've contributed that to the Oregon Kelp Alliance. So those are OUW slides of data. We're happy to put that together. But anyway, so it's the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife does periodic statewide surveys. We don't do them at individual sites. But we encourage everybody to be aware of those comparisons. We're doing them on a decadal basis. Because of the flux and importance, we're repeating that now for 2 years.
Oh, wow.
But it's very expensive. You know, every time we fly one of those, it's costing me $70,000 to $80,000. So these are really big costs in the surveys. We're seeing some very interesting patterns, though, in addition to the ones we've talked about, sites that are really blossoming in the face of patchy decline elsewhere. We're also seeing a statewide shift towards land in the spatial distribution of whole cattle. We don't have enough info on giant cattle. But that's curious. Something's going on there. I'm not sure why that is. Anyways, we'll try to keep that going, but it costs us a lot.
Thanks for speaking.
Thank you for
Yeah, Ken.
Another component of monitoring that we often don't talk about, but and consistency is important, is the social monitoring. We're going to have to come back to OPAC, and because they said, come back in a few years and tell us how things are going. Having consistent social monitoring of how many volunteer hours did you have, how many visitor intercepts did you have, so that we can document that these Rocky Habitat site designations with community involvement are a good thing.
Or what was the impact of designation? Yeah. Before we move into the last section of the conversation, I was wondering if folks who maybe haven't spoken up as much, is there anything that's on your mind or anything that's coming up for you?
That's good.
I've just been thinking about like how Surf Rider can add value to what you guys are already doing or share information especially. So yeah, I have some notes for you.
Excellent. Thank you. Yeah, Blake, did you have any kind of reflections on, as you're like sort of new in the position, is anything kind of...
There is so much information, so it's kind of overloaded for
right now. Right, that makes sense.
Position for 8 months, so I've just been gathering as much as I can, you know, with signage and all the things that we deal with the state parks. There's sometimes information overload on signages, and so
right.
Trying to figure out how the best way to present some information without just blocking the beautiful view itself.
Right.
And so, I mean... There is so much information here that I'm not, I mean, it's all new to me in some regards, so I'm just trying to absorb as much as I can.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
So one thing I do know is that at most parks, or state parks, there's like some kind of management plan or like park plan. And so I'm curious, one, where that lives, and two, if you see any kind of overlaps so far in the discussion in terms of like values that or goals, you know, if there's any kind of alignment, because we definitely don't want to create a site management plan for Cape Fowler that like, you know, does not align with the park plan.
So we have what you call like park master plans.
Master
kind
plan,
of
yeah.
Those frameworks that, you know, over the decades of time, you know, you don't ebb and flow with trends so much. You kind of hear some things, and hear things we would be willing to do in a park and add to it. Nothing really here is like contrary to the master plan there. That's definitely, there's always been a site that's ripe for interpretation. Even just about safety on the ocean shore itself, that's a big thing in park operations. I mean, folks have been there before, you see it. It's like, oh my God, I've stopped before. It's like, get off the beach. You're like, what are you talking about? And here comes the waves, you know. So we get that part of it. And then Burke mentioned that there, we do have the good artistic interpretive sign that heads that 333 or something like that. If you can scatter those along in a series, I think that would be great. And then just a matter of, those things are very expensive. and where those GIF files live is important too, because the ones like, hey, we can just replace it, and that architect's out of business, and the files went with their hard drive. So if we can kind of have that, that's some of the lesson learned.
Yeah.
We start building infrastructure of science.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's also the visitor center, right there, right? And that's managed and staffed by Parks as well, right?
Volunteers,
yeah. Yeah. Are there any kind of like structured programs that come, or like do they lead kind of talks or something at the...
They do. There's some historical information. We're kind of going through an interpretive process right now and trying to figure out exactly what we're going to present. There's different signages up there from the Historical Society has a couple of signages that are out there. There's also signages that we have for the intern. And I'm trying to gather, I've talked to several, just trying to, that area has got so many different viewpoints of it. It's really trying to focus in is, what are we trying to teach here? What are we trying to really interpret what we're trying to see here?
Right.
And so that's one of the things that we're trying to, that area has so many different stories and so much different environment that has evolved over the years is where we're trying to hone in on. And this information here is great because I mean, I don't want to be the sole purpose. Being there for 8 months, I really love the information that's coming in, so that way when all of this is being decided is that I can at least have several different viewpoints of it. What is important for that area to be processed for people that do visit those areas. But there are some renovations that's going to be going on to that building as well.
Okay.
So maybe some of these things can be incorporated. The other aspect is the cultural resources, the archaeology that has to be done in these areas where the signages in.
Right.
It's, we just can't go dig in.
Yeah.
And so it takes a process, and that's part of the funding that goes involved with it. It's a process. One sign, we don't just go put signs up. Sometimes it takes us 6 months to a year to find a good area to make sure we can dig there. If there's archaeological hotspot, like for example, Devil's Punch Bowl area, it's a hotspot for any kind of cultural resources that are in. And a lot of our areas, state parks are. These areas have been, we're not the first ones there.
Absolutely. Did you have a comment? No, please. You know a thing or two about that area.
Well, also just like what you're saying about cultural resources and making sure that tribes in the area tell those stories and are the voice of that signage or information sharing about that. Those areas are Celeste's original part of Celeste's original reservation, and then they were lost over time through the allotment process.
Brianna, how are they doing out there?
They're at the end of the last.
They're like wrapping up?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So just want to put a feeler out there. Do we want to jump into enforcement, or do we want to go to a break? Because we can online, assuming he can stay through the break, Ryan Howell from Oregon State Police is with us. And so when we come back together as a whole group, we could bring enforcement questions up there and we could hear, their reflections. Or I'm happy to jump into it now. So feeler, how's everyone feel? Do we want
to
have him in the room when we talk about it? All right. So is everyone okay if we wait to talk about that? All right.
Should I turn off the heat, but everybody can have to speak up? What's that?
That's the ice machine. It's pretty noisy, too.
I know.
All right, let's take a break. We'll take about 10 minutes. We've got snacks, and we're welcome to write all of our signs over there. All right, great.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice to meet you in person.